What we see in a lot of practices where embezzlement happens is there's one person who handles money. And no oversight, no division of duties whatsoever. And that gives that person the opportunity to both steal the money and then conceal the fact that it happened.
This is Growth in Dentistry, a dental intelligence podcast, where we ask the question, what does growth in dentistry mean to you? I'm Steve Jensen, a data dental nerd and your host. Welcome everyone to another episode of the Growth in Dentistry podcast. I am very excited for today's episode. Recently, I introduced the topic of embezzlement in dentistry. I think it's something that probably doesn't get talked about enough. And I was left wanting more. I was just like, hey, I got to know some of the, I want to hear from an expert, someone who's been doing this for a long time. And so today's guest is exactly that. I'm bringing the industry's oldest embezzlement, David. Now you can tell me if there's other words you want to put on the company, but the oldest expert in embezzlement, it's Prosperident. And I've got the CEO from Prosperident, David from Prosperident, that's going to join me. And I'm very excited for the episode. Now, before we jump in with David, a couple of quick notes. Number one, if you are a new listener to the podcast, thank you for joining. If you like the content, please like, subscribe, get notifications. It helps us get the word out to more and more folks here in dentistry. The second thing, I just want to give a huge shout out to Dental Intelligence for sponsoring this podcast. It wouldn't be possible without their help. So thank you to them, their marketing team, for producing this week after week after week. It's a lot of work and I'm grateful for them. As always, they have a special offer. If you'll just check out a demo of DI, they will give you a $50 gift card for just seeing what we're doing. If it's been a while since you've checked it out, there's some cool new features. We've got a cool new referral scorecard. We've got a cool new insurance scorecard that's coming up to understand, hey, like which of my insurance plans is the most profitable? Where am I getting, where, which ones has the most patients? There's some really cool analysis that's coming out here soon. If you haven't checked us out for a while, it might be worth checking it out. Okay, without any further ado, I wanna get right into this episode. This is gonna be a longer episode. So for those listening, I'm gonna treat this one as more of a deep dive. So we'll probably end up going, you know, 40, 45 minutes if you're listening, because this is a topic that you don't wanna like scan over too quickly. One other quick note, just so that listeners coming into this have the right mindset. This is not going to be a true crime podcast where we're sharing detailed specifics of how individuals in dental practices have committed the crime of embezzlement. And so we're not going to hit that, but we are going to talk about embezzlement in dentistry. And I'm so excited to bring David Harris on to talk about this topic. So David, welcome to the podcast. You know, say hello to the folks out there.
Good to be here. And Steve, I think you just called me old somewhere in there. I don't think of myself as old. I really look at myself as living history.
Yeah, I don't think. Yeah. And for those that are listening and not watching, David doesn't look old. He is spry. He's got that young energy about him. But I may have called you old. I may have called you old because Prosperident, I was looking at the website. Prosperident was founded in 1989. Go Taylor Swift. That's her, you know, but her Eras tour just ended. But I was born in 1988. So when this company was started, and I don't consider myself super young anymore. I just turned 36. But you guys have been doing this for a very long time. Like I mentioned in the beginning, Prosperident is the industry's oldest. And maybe a better word would be the most mature, right? Had just been around the block company when it comes to financial crimes in dentistry and embezzlement specifically. So I kind of want to start high level, David. Will you kind of give us maybe a little overview? Like, why did you even get into this 35 years ago? And then we'll talk about, you know, some of the kind of set some of the stage about like some stats in dentistry maybe, and, you know, why this is a good topic. And then we'll go from there.
Absolutely. And the story of how I got here is kind of neat. It was totally by accident. I'd like to claim that I had some kind of master plan or vision and I followed it. And the truth is a little stranger than that.
Mm-hmm.
I was an Army investigator. I did investigation for a bank. I quit my bank job one day because I got frustrated and I moved back to my hometown. And I'd been there about a week and a half when the phone rang, and it was a guy I knew from high school who was a dentist now. And he said to me, "I think my front desk person is stealing, and I don't have anyone else to call." And his timing was magnificent. You don't remember this part, but in 1989, there was no PVR, there was no Netflix. You know, the entertainment options available to you were kind of limited.
Yeah.
And I was bored silly. So I said to my friend, "Sure, I'll come to your practice tonight after it closes, and we'll get to the bottom of this." So I went to his practice that night. Now, this was also, Steve, 1989 BC. In other words, before computers. And in those days, practices used this old manual system called pegboard.
Yeah.
And in pegboard, the amount that each patient owed the practice was recorded on what was called a ledger card. So it was kind of a heavy cardstock card. And on that was written in by hand, of course, how much the patient owed. So I got to the practice, and my friend shoved a bunch of these cards at me. And I said, "No, we're going to go at this a little bit differently. Show me where she works." So my friend took me over to the desk of the person he suspected, and I started going through the desk. And my friend was kind of going bug-eyed, like, "Are you allowed to do this? You know, aren't you invading her privacy somehow?" And I had to explain to him that it isn't actually her desk, it's your desk. She just works there. And what cracked the case was that I found taped under one of her drawers what we refer to as her cheat book. So a lot of thieves need to keep track of what they've done so that they know what's real and what's fiction in the patient accounts. And in 2024, 2025, that cheat book is probably an Excel spreadsheet on a computer somewhere. In 1989, it was an old-fashioned notebook. So I found the book. And once I found the book, it was all pretty easy. And within a couple of hours, we had a pretty clear picture of what had gone on. She had stolen about $35,000, which was big in 1989. And my friend was glad that I solved the crime. He wasn't happy, of course, that he'd been a victim. So he hit me up for one more favor. He said, "Can you come back tomorrow morning? Because I'm going to fire her, and I'd kind of like you there." Okay, I'm probably going to be bored tomorrow too, so sure.
Yeah.
So I went back the next morning, and we fired her. You know, it was all done in about 20 minutes. My friend promised to buy me dinner that I'll mention has never happened. Still to this day. And I just kind of shrugged my shoulders and walked away. And I thought that was interesting, but I didn't really see a career path.
Yeah.
Well, 2 weeks later, it got weird. And what happened was I had an appointment at my own dentist's office. And I got there, and I had my hand on the front door, and I was about to go in. And I looked through the glass panel in the front door, and sitting at his front desk was the same woman I helped fire 2 weeks ago.
Oh, no.
What I said next was not polite. And I turned around hoping she didn't see me, and I sprinted to a payphone because you didn't carry a cell phone around back then. And I called the practice, and I used a little bit of deception to get past her and got my doctor on the phone. And when he answered, I told him about the time bomb that was ticking at his front desk, and he hired me. And that was my first client. And by the time I got his work done, the local Henry Schein rep realized what I was doing. And he had a couple of other clients that he was worried about, and so I was doing their investigations. Now, a lot has changed in the past 35 years. You know, computers and the internet and the ability to move data around, which is vitally important to your company as well as mine. Those things have all greatly changed how we do things, but some things haven't changed. There's still a lot of theft in dentistry. In fact, there's a lot more now than there was then.
Yeah, and what is a lot? Like, what? How often is this actually happening?
The best number I can give you is that there's about a 70% chance that a dentist will be embezzled at some point in their career.
Okay.
Doesn't mean this year, but sooner or later. The ADA did a study, the American Dental Association, about 5 years ago, and what they found was that roughly half of dentists had already been stolen from.
And knew about it. So
they knew about it. Yeah. And when you factor in some,
that as a qualifier, because I'm sure there are plenty of folks that have been stolen from that don't know about it. So those ones knew about it.
Yeah, this survey was definitely underreported for that reason. And also because there are probably some dentists who knew about it and didn't want to share that with the ADA for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you have to layer the likelihood that the other 50 odd percent will get embezzled in the rest of their careers.
Mm-hmm.
So 70% is a pretty good number.
And then the other question I have with that is like how, I don't want to like say that like all embezzlement isn't bad, but like how bad is the average embezzlement? Are we talking like, you know, $100 and that's like the one time I got embezzled from is someone, you know, snuck a couple of 50s out of a drawer? Or are we talking like if it happens, it's typically, you know, to the tune of thousands of dollars?
The average from our case files is over $100,000.
Whoa, really?
And those small embezzlements happen. You know, typically, Steve, if somebody can get $50 out of the drawer today, they can also get $50 out tomorrow and next week.
Yeah, so then it just keeps going.
You know, and one of the differences between embezzlement and a lot of other crimes is it's kind of repeated victimization of the same person.
Mm-hmm.
So if an embezzler's got any brains at all, they will do it in small amounts, you know, that sort of keep it below the pain point of the doctor.
Yeah.
And a typical embezzler will take a couple of $1,000 a month.
Hmm.
And if you know, which in a practice that might bring in $100,000 a month is significant. I'm not in any way diminishing that, but a lot of dentists wouldn't notice 2,000 missing dollars in a month.
Hmm. Yeah, one of the things that I think about when I think about that is like, what does it feel like to be the dentist to find out that that's happened to you? Like, I'm just imagining, you know, you're working so hard, you have this team of individuals that you've hired that are local, and you're just like, in your mind, I imagine, like, you're just trying to help them out. Like, we just had for context, you know, this is almost Christmas time. We just did a holiday Christmas party with all of our sales and marketing team here at DI, and it was so fun because everyone brought their spouses and kids, and there were like 30 little babies in people's arms, and then, you know, like about 100 little kids kind of just running around our office. And it was one of those moments when you're like, man, what we're doing is cool. Like, we have this business, but behind it are these families and this community that's just so fun to know that that's why we're all out here working, you know, is to help, you know, give a life to all these kids. And so as a small business owner, I can just imagine you feel so like closely connected to this team. You're all working so closely together every day. And that would be hard to recover from. Like, you work with these dentists. Is that something like, cause I would hope, I mean, I'm imagining in my mind, and then I'll shut my mouth and let you talk. I'm imagining if like that happened to me, I would have a hard time like trusting individuals afterward. Like, that could mess me up as a leader. So talk us through a little bit of like maybe that emotional side, and then we can maybe move into some of the more practical stuff. But that's, I think, relevant too. Like, if I'm listening to this podcast, it might freak me out, one. And then two, if like it's happened to me, it might, you know, be hard to recover from that as a leader.
Absolutely. To answer your first question, it feels horrible. Dental offices tend to be small businesses, as you say, with relatively few employees, and those employees work in pretty close physical proximity.
Yeah.
The other thing that dental practices have that not necessarily every business has is a little bit of shared adversity.
Yeah.
You know, ask any dentist how many times they've asked a patient, you know, how are you doing today? And the answer is, well, great, if I wasn't sitting right here.
Yes, there's a little bit of therapy that happens in those dental chairs.
And that sort of outside pressure makes staff bond in a way that they might not bond in another business of the same size.
So true.
So you start there. And then from there, you know, most dentists are good, decent people who are probably more caring as employers than most. In other words, they recognize this sense of family and they treat these people like extended family. And when somebody in that position sticks a knife in your back, It takes an emotional toll. And we have had to, over the years, talk a lot of dentists off the ledge. The other thing, Stephen, you know, I know you spend a lot of time talking to dentists as well. They tend to internalize this. You know, I was negligent. I didn't do all the things I should have. And I've said to a lot of dentists over the years, I don't care how lax you think you were in running your practice. That never makes it okay to steal from you. But their first instinct is to self-blame. And that does a couple of things. It underestimates the sophistication of the embezzler's thought process. I mean, if you're a dentist and I work for you and I want to steal from you, the first thing I do is I consider what you look at in the practice and more topically, what you don't. And I build my embezzlement to navigate around your scrutiny. So, you know, it's really tempting to be reactionary when, you know, for example, let's assume that a dentist entrusts a staff member to make bank deposits. And, you know, some money goes missing out of bank deposits and it doesn't get found for a while, eventually it gets caught. And the first thing the dentist does is smack themselves in the forehead and say, you know, if only I had made the bank deposit myself, that would not have happened. And in a really narrow sense, they're right. The slightly
But
bigger
also in a
picture.
practical sense, it's like, no, like you should be able to have trusted advisors in the business that can do that and not
Well,
steal.
that's true, but the real issue here is the powerful forces that drive embezzlers. And if you're a dentist and I work for you, and the first way that the first idea that I have as to how I should steal from you gets blocked because of something you're doing. That doesn't send me home to join the church choir. What it does is force me to think of another way. And there are a lot of options available to thieves. I mean, we've seen literally hundreds of different methodologies of stealing over the years. So, you know, when you point to one, when you see how it happened, and then with the benefit of hindsight, you say, okay, well, if I'd made the deposit myself, that wouldn't have happened. Again, in a very narrow sense, that's true. However, the chance is overwhelming that they would have stolen from you in some other way.
No, I've got a question. Maybe since we're not going to go down the path too much of how people do it, but I am interested to hear, you know, as we're like flirting with that topic, to hear like why do people do it? You have uncovered, you know, so many cases over the last 35 years, and I'm assuming, yeah, you have just like this lifelong repository of examples to understand like, hey, why do people do it? Like, what gets someone to the point where they do that?
The people who steal are pushed by one of two forces. And sometimes it's need. And by need, I mean this is somebody who can't, whose income doesn't support their expenses. And you know, maybe it's overspending, but in a lot of cases, there's some identifiable cause. I mean, maybe their spouse lost their job. Or maybe this is a person who's going through a divorce and you know, dealing with two in they start with two incomes funding the same household, and they go from that to two households and a bunch of attorney bills. Maybe there's an addiction, you know, gambling, substance abuse, whatever. But for whatever reason, this person is in a position where X comes into their family each month, and 110% of X goes out. And you can sustain that for a while. I mean, you run up your credit cards, you maybe borrow from friends or family, but eventually you hit the wall. And there's just nowhere else to turn. And those people sometimes, not always, but some of those people will steal. And the second group, and sorry, the needy folks feel bad about it. I mean, they know it's wrong and they regret doing it, but they just don't think they have any options. And then you've got greedy thieves, and they're motivated a little bit differently. Greedy thieves tend to be a little bit narcissistic. So they think that society is not rewarding them properly for their talents. And they steal what they think they should be paid in the first place. So it's an entitlement factor.
Is one of
And
those more common than the others? Because I imagine that was one of my questions. Like, I could imagine someone being like, well, you know, in the small dental practice, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot of effort to kind of figure out what a dent what that what a dentist is earning, you know, or conceptually roughly what they make. And especially if you're an office manager, it's pretty obvious, you know. Is that more common, or is that not that common to have someone just think, you know what, like, this doctor's making so much money, I should make more, and it's more than narcissistic? Or is it driven, which one's more common, or is it driven more from need, or is it not necessarily one's like the overwhelming common one?
No, I mean, some of this is tied to business cycles. So in times when the economy is struggling, you tend to see the needy thieves come out. You know, a great example was in COVID. And, you know, a lot of dental practices in a lot of states had enforced shutdowns. And, you know, typically the dentist paid the staff through that process. But at the same time that was happening, a lot of their spouses got laid off from their positions. So, you know, if my spouse works for an airline, for example, then, you know, they were almost certainly going to be furloughed in COVID. So tough economies tend to bring out the needy thieves. And when the economy is roaring along, that's when the greedy people tend to become more visible, because what they see is their friends getting ahead faster than they are. So, you know, if my friends own businesses, or maybe they sell real estate or something, and the economy's booming, they're going to do really well. And I'm still drawing my hourly salary, and not really sharing in the prosperity that I see my friends participating in. And that, for some people, that bothers them, and it bothers them to the point where they do something about it. I couldn't tell you kind of what percentage of embezzlement is from each cohort. But I'll say again, we see them at different times.
Yeah, the cycles, that seems to make sense to me. That seems to track, like, just these pressures that would cause someone to start having those thoughts on either end. One of the things, you know, I think about with this, if I'm listening, is, okay, like, it's more prevalent than I probably thought it was, and that can make me, as an if it's an owner listening, or even an office manager, you know, oh, that's another question. Is there kind of a common thread on the role within the practice that does this? You know, is it most commonly, you know, an office manager, or is it an associate that does this, or is an associate dentist, or is it you know, like a financial coordinator? Like, talk us through that maybe. And then maybe we talk about safeguards after that. Like, okay, like, knowing kind of what we know, why people do it, and what roles might be the ones that do this most commonly, maybe we move into get more of a safeguards conversation.
Definitely. Anybody could steal. How somebody steals is a function of what their access is. So if I work in a practice as a dental assistant and I'm bitten by either of those afflictions we talked about, need or greed, maybe I steal supplies and sell them on eBay.
I see, yeah.
If I'm a bookkeeper and I'm not involved in incoming funds to the practice, but I'm the person who pays the bills and stuff, then maybe I find a way to create another expense and in a way that benefits me. If we're talking about theft of patient payments or insurance payments, which is the overwhelming majority of theft in dental practices, then that's got to be somebody who's in the revenue cycle. So, office manager, financial coordinator, receptionist. In a lot of cases, it's the office manager simply because they have the biggest opportunity. In other words, if
And the
I'm a
most access.
receptionist, there's an office manager probably somewhere supervising me. And one of their mandates from the doctor is to make sure I don't steal. However, office managers tend to have much less oversight from the doctor than their subordinates have from the office manager. So they tend to have the greatest opportunity, and that's why probably they make up the bulk of the thieves that we see.
Yeah, fascinating. I think that makes sense. I think that tracks with us intuitively what I would guess. But yeah, it also makes sense that some of these other roles, you know, if they're in that needy situation, could get creative, you know, so not to be overlooked necessarily. So talk through maybe, you know, what, as you work with practices, I'm sure you have some folks reach out that are like, I think it might be happening, and they engage you and they find out, oh, there's no evidence. You know, just for listeners' context, I pulled up David's bio here, and David is a certified fraud examiner. He's a forensic CPA. He is certified in financial forensics. He's a licensed private investigator. Like, you have a lot of certifications. I'm assuming you kind of garnered these over the years. But when someone starts talking to you, I'm assuming most of the time it's because they're pretty confident, or they think it might be happening. And the outcome isn't always that it is for sure happening. But I'm assuming you guys do always go, regardless if it's happening or not, you have some conversation around safeguards. Can you talk us through maybe some of that type stuff?
Absolutely. We actually have a whole product around safeguards.
Okay, cool.
In other words, people come to us in two places. Some of them are at risk.
Yeah.
And for at-risk people, what we do is an investigation. An investigation means we look back into what's happened in their practice, and we determine whether or not money was missing.
Mm-hmm.
We also have the group who come to us, and we mutually decide, you know, they're not at a high risk right now, but let's build the systems that will keep them in that place.
Yeah.
In other words, Steve, in a lot of practices, the only reason the doctor's not being stolen from is the staff haven't made the decision to steal,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty unstable. You know, staff change, their situations change, and you know, to have staff honesty is the thing that's keeping you safe is a little bit fragile.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a lot of dentists who come to us and say, okay, let's put the systems in place that will protect me.
Yeah.
And a lot of things you can do in that area. You know, the first thing is, I will say that most dentists do a terrible job of pre-employment screening. So the chance of bringing a rotten apple into your barrel is pretty high. And one statistic.
And what does that look like? Like, is there I assume there would be a record if someone in your first story you shared where, like, did that woman have like a criminal record? How does that work?
There are a lot of repeat offenders. And yeah. I'm going to give your audience a statistic they absolutely need to hear, which is this: 70 million Americans, which equates to 1 in 4 adults.
I was going
to
say, that's a high percentage.
Has a criminal record.
Whoa, really?
Really. And to be clear, not every one of those criminal records would stop me from hiring somebody.
Oh, like, are traffic tickets included in that?
No.
No. Okay. Yeah.
No.
What constitutes as a crime?
This would be a felony or misdemeanor.
Okay, cool.
So, you know, it might be assault, it might be check fraud, it might be embezzlement.
Okay.
But it might be possession of marijuana in a state where that's not legal.
Yep.
And that's where I was going with this. You know, somebody who has a criminal record because they got caught in college with marijuana 20 years ago, you know, that wouldn't
that's
stop
probably fine, yeah.
That wouldn't stop me from hiring them.
Yeah.
On the other hand, check fraud 2 years ago is a definite showstopper.
Absolutely.
My point is, though, if a dentist doesn't do a criminal record check as part of their pre-employment screening, they're playing Russian roulette and they're going to lose.
Hmm.
There are other parts to pre-employment screening, too. One thing that absolutely amazes me is that the norm in dentistry is that drug testing of applicants is not done. I don't get it. Dental practices have the keys to the pharmacy.
Yeah, they do in a really interesting way, which is why, you know, there are folks that are out there talking about, you know, doctors struggling with, you know, some substance abuse and stuff like that. But I hadn't considered, you know, that as being a possibility. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, there certainly are doctors who have struggled, and you know, you will see every couple of weeks in the news, you know, some doctor losing their license over prescription abuse. I saw one of those yesterday. And that's a whole other issue. But there's also a possibility that you end up hiring somebody who has substance abuse issues, and
yeah.
You know, aside from what that might do to their job performance, it also may mean at some point that they look at you as being a really good source of drugs.
Yeah.
And a lot of states have gone to electronic prescribing, and there are some safeguards there, but in general, I think somebody can find a way around them. And especially where prescribing is linked to practice management software, it tends to be relatively easy to transcend. So I would say to a dentist, wouldn't you be somewhat interested in whether the dental assistant passing you sharp instruments today is high or not? And if so, we should be drug testing applicants. What I see is how much of crime is driven by drugs. And it's an easy thing to do with an applicant and may stop you from making a hiring mistake.
And
So
are there typically, I'm trying to picture a bunch of the dental practice owners that I know, and I personally never been drug screened. So is there like are there just like are there typically local companies that do that kind of thing? And
there
is it a
are
very easy process?
in the last couple of years, it's gotten a whole lot easier. There is now saliva. Typically, drug testing was done through blood or urine, which meant that you had to go to a lab and,
It's like
they
a
sort
pretty big, yeah, not a pretty big, but a decent sized ask. It's like a little more, invasive, but.
Well, and if you live in out in the country somewhere, you might have to drive 80 miles to get to a drug lab. What's happened in the past few years is there is now saliva-based drug testing. And what that means is that it can be remotely supervised. In other words, if you think back to the COVID days, there were COVID tests that you could do at home on your computer, like we're doing now, and somebody would watch you and confirm that the test was properly done. The exact same thing can be done for drug testing now. So that makes it easier if you happen to live in a community that does not have a testing lab.
And then for the other one, for getting background checks done, I have rental properties, so I just have done those through, some systems that are associated with like landlord software. Are there good solutions that dental practices can use that you suggest just employment wise?
Yeah, there are. What a lot of dentists hope for is that there's some online site where they can go and pay $50 and get a background screening on somebody. There is no such site. And there's a thing that you probably are familiar with in your landlord world called the Fair Credit Reporting Act. And what FCRA does is it sets a certain set of standards on companies that provide background checking information. Those online sites do not meet those standards. So it's actually a violation of the terms of service of those sites to use them for pre-employment screening.
Interesting.
What you really need to do is go to a background checking company. And there are plenty of them out there, including a few that kind of concentrate on dental practices.
And is that something that you guys do as well, or do you have companies that you suggest?
We do not do it. The company that we use is called besthire.com. But there are a number of good choices out there. This costs a little money. It's $300 or $400 to do a proper workup on somebody.
So is that something you do? Do you do that for every role, or is that like, hey, they're just these roles that are maybe at most risk for that?
I would do it for every role. I think the assumption dentists make in some places, like when we're talking about, for example, dental hygienists or associate dentists, typically having a criminal conviction is a disqualification for licensing. So if you're a hygienist and you have a criminal conviction, normally your licensing body the licensing bodies won't give you a license. The only problem with that is there's typically a 3 or 4 year cycle.
Interesting.
In other words, if I get convicted of something today, it may be a few years before the licensing body even asks me the question, assuming, of course, I answer truthfully and then denies me a license.
So the licensing body is not going, and they don't have their system connected somehow with, criminal record systems. Like they're
They
not.
absolutely don't. They on renewal, they will ask you the question. And whether they do any kind of verification, that typically isn't done annually.
Yeah, interesting.
Maybe every 3 or 4 years, the hygiene licensing body will do a We'll check with a background checking company to see if somebody has a criminal record. So there's a long cycle before it catches up with people. And in answer to your question, I don't care what job somebody has in a practice. They're dealing with vulnerable populations. They're dealing with potentially money, potentially with drugs, definitely with HIPAA protected information. There are lots and lots of reasons why we want to keep people who do not have integrity out of those roles, and proper pre-employment screening is how you do that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So thinking about other safeguards. So one, we've just talked about bringing team members into the business. So there's that criminal records check. There is, drug testing that can be done. Are there any others before you want to talk about, like, okay, now we've got our current team, what are some of the good safeguards to have in place?
No, let's go there. Okay. The first thing is division of duties. And what we see in a lot of practices where embezzlement happens is there's one person who handles money.
Mm-hmm.
And no oversight, no division of duties whatsoever. And that gives that person the opportunity to both steal the money and then conceal the fact that it happened. So division of duties is really about making it so that if I want to steal, I have to involve a coworker. And for a would-be thief, it's a really risky conversation to go to one of the people you work with and say, Steve, I want to steal from our boss, but I really need your help.
Yeah.
Just the fact that I have to do that to steal will stop most wannabe embezzlers.
Yep.
So when we divide up duties, the revenue cycle basically has six things. Treatment gets entered into practice management software. Patients and insurance companies get billed.
Mm-hmm.
The money gets received. It gets recorded in practice management software. There's a balancing activity that happens at the end of the day. And then money gets deposited. Those are the six steps in the revenue cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And I have three rules. The first rule is the only people who should ever enter treatment are clinicians in the clinical area.
Yep.
The old fashioned way of sending out a paper chart to the front desk and having the front desk record what happened is a really bad idea on a whole bunch of levels, including embezzlement. So first rule is treatment entered by clinicians who were in the operatory when it happened.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're talking about the doctor's operatory, typically it's the assistant. In a hygiene operatory, normally the hygienist enters what was done.
Yeah.
You've got five remaining tasks in the revenue cycle. Patients get billed, money gets received, it gets recorded, there's balancing at the end of the day, and then there's a deposit.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two rules to cover those five tasks. First of all, nobody should do more than two of those. And second, the two that somebody does should not be sequential.
Hmm.
So whoever does balancing at the end of the day, for example, can't make the deposit. It has to be somebody else.
Great.
And if you're in a big practice and you have five receptionists and an office manager and a financial coordinator, no problem.
Yep.
You've got enough bodies at the front desk to divide this stuff up. If we're talking about a kind of classic solo practice, one dentist, one assistant, one hygienist, one front desk. Now you can't do that, and you probably have to do some things personally, and you might also involve some of your clinical people in some of these activities. For example, it might be your assistant who does the balancing at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. I'm thinking about, because I just met with the practice this last week who's that exact profile that you just mentioned. And, doctor feels overworked and is like not, doesn't want to take on more responsibility. I could see how you would just want to be like, okay, let me just give all of this to, the one team member who seems to be the closest to the revenue cycle and could probably just knock it out. Like it certainly would be more efficient. But yeah, maybe, I hadn't thought about that. Maybe the assistant role is a good one that could help cover some of those gaps. Or, in this situation, the front office manager is cross-trained as a hygienist as well. So it's kind of like jumps between assisting hygiene and front office duties. And the doctor shares some roles where the doctor although the doctor wants to get rid of those roles, I think the team would have to grow for that to happen. You know, maybe that's one of the incentives to say, hey, to help put better safeguards for my business, we can grow this thing, and then that creates a little more flexibility.
I'm not sure that's the strongest impetus for growth in most practices.
Yeah, no, probably not.
but there's a way to do it. And the other thing I talk about sometimes is the difference between delegation and abdication.
Mm-hmm.
And delegation means that I'm going to give you a job to do, but I'm going to enforce accountability, and I'm going to also invest enough mental energy to understand what you're doing well enough that I can supervise it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's abdication, which is, Steve, I'm giving you this job and I don't ever want to think about it again.
Yeah.
And a lot of dentists abdicate, especially when it comes to administrative activities, when really what needs to happen is to delegate.
Hmm.
Even as I say this, I know there are dentists in the audience who are saying, yeah, but that's not what I signed up for. You know, I want my joy in life is being a clinician, not running the place.
Yeah.
And what I'll say to them is you can't have it both ways.
Yeah.
If you want to be a practice owner and have the benefits of practice ownership, then with that come certain responsibilities.
For sure.
If you don't want those responsibilities, that's fine. But let's just acknowledge now that you shouldn't be a practice owner.
Yeah.
You know, go work for a DSO or teach at university or put a uniform on and serve your country.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you fundamentally don't want to oversee what your front desk is doing, you shouldn't be a practice owner.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is not necessarily like, you know, some listeners might hear that and be like, oh, that's kind of harsh, David. But like, I'll tell you guys, like, for me, as you were saying that about, you know, owning a dental practice, even me with rental properties, there's times where I think, okay, like that was a really good way to generate wealth, you know, in my early career, early life. And as I, you know, approach 40s, I start to think, hey, like maybe I don't want this burden of talking to tenants all the time and collecting past due rents and going and posting
fixing
notices.
Toilets.
Going and post, yeah, fixing toilets. And, you know, just got a text last week about a fridge that was making a funny noise. And, you know, maybe I would be okay, because there's great financial benefit return of being the owner operator. But maybe I'm getting to a point financially where I say, you know what, like maybe I would be okay just moving those into a, you know, a managed fund that have some tax benefits that give, you know, a more set IRR, but I don't have to do some of those things. And I know my annual return's less, but at the end of the day, like what really do I want out of my life? And I think that's okay for a practice owner to think that way as well. You know, if you're hearing this and you're like, yeah, you know, I don't know if I want to take on some of those responsibilities. That's not like so bad a thought either. Each decision has their, you know, their risk and reward for sure.
There are lots of great career paths in dentistry that do not involve practice ownership.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I think a lot of dentists view practice ownership as kind of the dental version of the American dream.
Yeah.
And, you know, that it may not be all it's cracked up to be, at least for them. So yeah. If you're hearing this and that's how you're feeling, acknowledge it and look for a good situation that plays into your strengths and doesn't carry the expectation for you to do things that you really don't want to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
So. Let's talk about a couple of other precautions or
yeah, please let's do
or safeguards that a dental practice owner can do. And the first one sounds so simple, but at the end of the day, there's a report from your software that says, here's what happened today.
Mm-hmm.
And you need to look at it.
Every day.
You need every day, and not just every day, but today.
Yeah.
In other words, if you throw that thing in your basket on your desk and you go home and you look at it 2 days later, it's meaningless.
Hmm.
It really needs to be done while it's fresh in your mind, partly so you catch errors. And, you know, it's the easiest thing in the world to do a four service filling on somebody and have it recorded in your software as a two service. There may not even be theft behind that, but it still is going to cost you a fair amount of money, especially if that's an ongoing pattern.
Yep.
So what I tell dentists is do not try to match up the collections from today with today's deposit, because There are too many timing differences that make that a really difficult calculation. Do that as a monthly thing. But look at your report today and ask yourself two questions. Does it line up with what I remember happened today, and does it make sense?
Yeah.
And if the answer to one of those is no, then you got to dig deeper. The second thing that you need to do is what I call financial articulation. And this is something, Steve, that I've never seen anybody else talk about. And when you hear it, I'm sure you'll understand the logic. What financial articulation means is this. Last month, if your practice was open 16 days, and in one hand, you have 16 day end reports from your software, and these are the ones you checked each day before you went home. Mm-hmm. They should also be ones that you printed yourself. In other words, don't allow people to print reports that you rely on, because that opens the door to selective reporting. Yeah. So at the end of each day, you print your report, you look at it, you put your initials on it, so that you know that that's the one you saw, and you lock it up. And then at the end of the month, you go and get all those reports and you print a month-end summary from your software. Mm-hmm. So now what you're doing in articulation is you're comparing three numbers, and there are the fees that you billed, the adjustments that were made, and the payments received. You add up those numbers from the 14 or 16 day-end reports that you have, and you compare them to the month-end totals, and they should be exactly the same.
Yeah, great.
If they're not exactly the same, then what happened is somebody came in after hours and they did stuff in your software that they did not want you to see. Mm-hmm. In other words, articulation is the way of enforcing that everything that's happened this month in your software is in one of those reports that you've printed. Mm-hmm. And nothing has kind of squirted by you.
Now, in some of those moments, do you ever find that there is space for some like small errors that team members make that aren't necessarily embezzlement? Like they fat finger a number, or they go and adjust something after the fact, and it wasn't necessarily.
Of course, but neither of those things, if they're done properly, will cause a discrepancy between the day ends and the month end.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, if on Tuesday I enter something wrongly and I fix it on Thursday and it's all in the same month.
Yeah. Great.
Then the sum of the day ends and the month end will be the same. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if I come in at 8 o'clock at night to fix that, and ask yourself why I would possibly do that. Mm-hmm. And I do a second day end that day and I don't hand it to the doctor. Now there will be a discrepancy between those 16 reports I have and what happened at month end.
Yep. And then we have to determine why. Yeah, that's very good. It's just a good system of accountability and just a safeguard. That's very good.
And it's very quick. I mean, what you're doing is adding three columns of numbers. It's a 10 or 15 minute job.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a huge ask.
The third control is now that we've confirmed that the day ends and month end articulate. Mm-hmm. Now what we do is we take our month end report. We look at the total collections and we compare that to the deposits at the bank.
Yeah. Perfect.
Are they going to add up exactly? Probably not, because there are going to be some transactions that are captured on a different day in the practice management software from when they hit the bank. For example, somebody comes in on the last day of the month and pays $4,000 by credit card. Mm-hmm. Your software will treat that as a payment this month, but the money won't hit your bank account until next month. Mm-hmm. So there are going to be some variances like that. However, those variances reverse.
Yep.
So if that's the only timing difference in November, what you're going to see is that in November, your practice management software collections are $4,000 greater than your bank deposits. However, in December, you're going to have a $4,000 bank deposit with no offset in practice management software because the other side happened in November.
Yep.
So if you look at these things over time, what you should see is kind of a rough sine wave. And if you don't see that, if you see a pattern where the stuff is increasing over time, that where the variance is increasing over time, then that's not timing, that's something else.
Yep.
And embezzlement is going to be the first guess.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Now, David, I can't believe how fast time has flown. We're coming up on the end of time. to wrap it up, I ask this question to every guest, and the question is, what does growth in dentistry mean to you? So I'd love to hear a response to that, and then we'll wrap up. It has been, you know, just I'll say this, it's been a gift to talk with you. It's been so fun to just learn from you and to be curious. So, David, what does growth in dentistry mean to you?
Sadly, one of the things that is growing noticeably in dentistry is the amount of employee theft. And I talked earlier about a study the American Dental Association did in 2019, where they asked dentists, had you been stolen from? And almost half, 47%, said yes. The ADA did the same survey 12 years earlier. So in 2007, they asked dentists the same question. And at that point, 35% of dentists said yes, they'd been stolen from. So over a 12-year period, the prevalence of embezzlement went up by about a third.
Yeah, wow.
And it doesn't stop there. The dollars stolen are climbing. You know, we have this part of our website called the Hall of Shame, and part of the Hall of Shame is what we call the Million Dollar Club.
Oof.
So these are thieves who get $1 million from their doctor, and yeah, there are a few of them. So
even that $100,000 was staggering to me earlier. That's like average to get that much taken. That's that's really surprised me.
It's unfortunate that this happens. It's unfortunate that it happens as often as it does. And when you talked about the effect on the dentist's ability to trust people and how that gets crippled, that's unfortunate too. But it is a growth business, and there are a lot of reasons for that. But what I want the audience to hear is, if you do the right things, and we talked about pre-employment screening, we talked about division of duties, and we talked about articulation, and we talked about doing that comparison between collections and deposits. If you do those things, I won't say you can't be embezzled, but you will lock out 90% of the people who want to steal from you. So what are you waiting for?
Yeah, I love, David, yours is an interesting invitation for growth. It's hey, everyone who's listening, please, let's make sure I use my forensic CPA and myriad of certifications as minimally as possible to go and actually find embezzlement. Let's hopefully use your skills as much as we can for your business to grow to inhibit that. Like it's a great invitation. So thank you for joining us today, and thank you to all the guests for coming and listening to David and learning from David Harris over at Prosper. And if you want to connect with, if folks want to connect with you, David, what's the best way to do that?
They can go to our website, which is www.prosperadent.com.
Great.
Or they can call us at our toll-free number, which is 888-398-2327. Again, 888-398-2327. And in either case, they can talk to us. We are very non-judgmental. You know, we never say to a dentist, how come you don't know that? Our goal is to be supportive, to answer the questions a dentist has, and also to be there for them emotionally, because in a lot of cases they need somebody saying to them, you know what, this isn't your fault.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you, David. And for those listening, definitely reach out to these guys. Like I said, they have been doing this for, you know, 3.5 decades and are certainly experts at it. It's been fun to have you on, David. And thank you to all the listeners for joining yet again for another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Steve Jensen, a fellow data nerd. Keep growing, and we'll talk soon. See you guys.